This is Jacqueline Pillsbury on June 27th, 2018 at the Princeton Public Library as part of the Voices of Princeton project. I'm here today with Bill and Pam Wakefield.
Yes, hi, I'm Pam Wakefield. I'm the one to be interviewed.
Hi, and I'm Bill Wakefield, and I will do the interviewing. To me, it's a different kind of interview, I guess, for both of us, because I'll be asking questions of Pam, and at least for many of these, I think I know the answers. The only thing is that some of the questions I'll ask are those from that are suggested by the Voices of Princeton project, and some are ones of our own making. So with that background, let me ask Pam first, why did you want to do VOP?
I wanted to do the Voices of Princeton. I wanted that comment to be in here. I love the idea of this project. I love StoryCorps. And I was here years ago when they did the Happy Wall Kong installation that is down in the main hall as you come into the library. And the Kong installation is made up of tiles donated by people from throughout the community, where they're telling something, the tiles themselves tell something about their language, their life in Princeton, and it's such an incredible collection that I hoped that we could put some kind of audio, or I always wish we'd have some kind of audio to kind of be the other bookend. And Hannah Schmidl here and Izzy Kasdanet from the Historical Society got it going.
So we met as teenagers and married while we were still in college. So much of Pam's story, your story, is also our story. So tell us a little bit about life before Bill.
Well, there's not a lot to tell about life before Bill. But I grew up in northern New Jersey. When I was really little, it was the Second World War, and my dad was stationed in San Diego with the Navy, so our family stayed out close to San Diego and came back to northern New Jersey. And I grew up in Bloomfield, New Jersey, which is a really nice community to grow up in. It is very blue-collar and very ethnically mixed, and I went through the public schools there and then moved to Montclair. Met Bill while I was in college. We married in our early 20s, and life together began.
And as they say, rest is history. So how did we end up here in Princeton?
Uh-huh. So I loved Montclair. Our children we lived in England for a while, but almost always in Montclair. And our children grew up there. My family was there, my friends, and Bill, you, my husband right here, worked for Exxon for all those years, but had a really nice opportunity for a job in Philadelphia. And it was just a job that you couldn't say no to. So for a while, we let the kids finish their school years in the Princeton and the Montclair public schools, but eventually either we were going to live apart or live somewhere in the middle between Philadelphia and Montclair. And unhappily, I said I would go, but I would only move. If I had to move, I'd move to Princeton. And so we did.
Well, I know that I dragged you kicking and screaming out of Montclair.
Pretty true.
So with that background and both of us having very strong roots in Montclair, what was your first reaction to Princeton when we got here? I mean, I know you knew something about it at the time, but What was the reaction when you got here, and how did our kids react to it when we got here?
Well, first of all, my dad, as you know, went to Princeton, and so did my brother. So it was not totally unfamiliar to me.
And before Bill, you dated.
I did.
Somebody at
yeah,
Princeton,
right.
So.
So our first job was tearing me out of my great big old house, which was a kind of a money pit in Montclair, and we came to Princeton, and I said, well, if I just have my old house, that house again, I'll be happy. But of course that was not possible in Princeton, because it's a very different, it's much newer, parts of it are much newer, and the parts that are old were well beyond what we could afford. So we got a really lovely, spacious, fairly new house, plenty of bedrooms, place for our three children and friends and family if anyone wanted to come visit us. And that was in the early 80s. And so it was a house, but it wasn't a home. And we all tried to pretend it was, but it wasn't. And we lived not far from Lake Carnegie, so when we'd walk up and down the lake, and I'd say, I'd be so much happier if I lived on the lake. And we watched and we watched and we watched for sale signs. And finally a for sale sign came up. And it was a house with many problems, but you can tell about buying it.
Well, that was an era when people didn't bid more than what the seller was asking for a house. So before it actually went on to the multiple listing system, there were four equal bids on the house at the asking price. So the question was, okay, we don't to this day know, well, how did the sellers decide to do a contract with us? And we figured that, okay, we already had a house in Princeton of comparable value, and they probably figured, well, they can afford it, they can have a mortgage already for something in this price range, and so we're a good bet. Or, as we sometimes like to think, they just liked us. We don't know, but anyway, that's how we finally got a house that Pam really liked.
I forgot to say that one of our few claims to fame in Princeton is that when we sold the house that we didn't love first, Toni Morrison bought it. So we were redeemed. And it was a hard economic time, but this was 1987. And Toni Morrison had just been hired by Princeton, and they brought her around in great style looking for a house. And she came to our house, and she walked in on the first floor, and she looked around, and she looked out the back window, and she said, well, if that tree is on the property that goes with this house, I'll buy the house. And it was, and she did. So we were really happy about that. It was a privilege to sell it to her, and really happy to live on the lake where we still live.
And what about the kids' reaction?
The kids' reaction to moving to Princeton from Montclair. Our two older children were just finished high school, and our youngest child, Liza, was in high school. And instead of putting her in the Princeton public schools, we thought it was a tough time to move her. So we put her in Princeton day school. And I was remembering a few days ago that within the few weeks of her time at Princeton day school, I picked her up from school, and she was sort of between laughter and tears, because she had heard from Montclair friends that a Montclair high school student had been shot by the police. And the same day in Princeton Day School, they had brought the entire school together to say that they thought somebody had stolen a backpack out of somebody, out of the hall where everybody left their backpacks because they didn't need security. So it was a change. I think further on down the road, our older children like coming here, and sort of as the years have evolved, it's probably a good time to say it now, they now have children and growing families, and their children love to visit Princeton, partly because we spoil them, but really in large part because Princeton has this incredibly good downtown, and they love that. So many towns don't have that anymore, so we feel very fortunate to have that.
How, you mentioned finding the house, and any more to say about what it was like to serve as that sort of...
Well, Montclair is an incredibly diverse town. And when we first came to Princeton, it didn't feel remotely as diverse. It wasn't. And that sort of was a visual change and a different feeling in the community. The town is so based around the university that a lot of the diversity comes from the faculty and staff working there, which is different from the diversity that's in Montclair.
When we first came down here, obviously we came down here because of a new job, and I was heavily involved in my career at that point. What did you do to adapt to this new life in a new town?
Well, first I whined, and then I decided that wasn't getting me anywhere. So I decided that I would look for a job, and we had friends who were academics who said, if you want to work for Princeton, look for a job in the department that you would like to be in and see if you can get your foot in the door there. And that's exactly what I did. I would have a degree in psychology, and as I started looking for jobs in the Princeton University openings, they wanted a temp in the office of the Department of Psychology, which was then in Green Hall. And so I applied for it, and I was terrified. I went to Human Resources and took a typing test, and I think I could type...
Not much.
I think it was like 13 words a minute if I put my heart and soul into it. But they let me go there anyway, and then there was about a 17-year-old girl who taught me how to use a Xerox machine, which was like learning to use a crane or something like that. It was so alien to me. But I went there and worked in the office, the big office then, where it was a secretarial pool, and that was before people wrote everything on their own computers, so the secretaries typed things up on the word processors and took dictation. And I don't think anyone knew quite what I should be doing there, but within a month or so of my being there, George Miller, who was Princeton's kind of world-renowned catch of the day, he was a very established cognitive psychology, very temperamental and a little difficult to work with, and they asked me if I would go down and be willing to ask him if I could work with him because he wanted somebody to help him. And I was old enough then not to be terrified of him, and so he hired me, and I spent the next just about 25 years working with him as his research assistant, and just worked on a lot of research projects with him, wrote grants, monitored the grants, hired people once in a while, fired people.
And what else did he call you?
I can't remember the word. Amanuensis.
He called you his intellectual butler.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I forgot that. You're right. So that I loved working at Princeton University. It's an incredible employer. I love being part of the campus every day. I exercise in Dillon Gym. We were just fortunate to have the link to the university because a lot of our friendships came from that. And it was just made the whole move to Princeton hard to complain about.
Now, we have agreed many times that 9/11 was had a major impact on our lives, as it did for the lives of the life of the whole country, and for Princeton. And we've talked a lot about that and how it's impacted us. Do you want to say something about that?
Yeah, we talked about what we talk about today. One of the questions that this Voices of Princeton suggests asking is, what's the biggest event you remember happening in Princeton? And that is definitely the biggest event I remember. The day that everybody's lives changed. And I can remember standing in our backyard looking at the sky and seeing military planes flying back and forth in the horizon. And we have family who worked in New York. Our son was in New York, just being worried about our children and their friends, and people died. And the next day, there was a community service in the chapel, and the whole town, it seemed, gathered there, and people held hands and wept together and sang together. And the intensity of that time is just now almost hard to describe. Things just changed that day, it was kind of a loss of innocence. And the days following, as I would walk back and forth on Nassau Street, I'd hear the church bells and the chapel bells ringing just as people went to memorial services and funeral services. And it was, you know, there were widows and children with no parents, and it was so close to home. And just a really, really huge period of adjustment that came after that. I think Bill and I talked about this as we got ready for this interview. I think one of the things that really changed for us was the fact that we now lived in a country that was, trust was gone, and we were nervous. People didn't want to fly. People were uncomfortable out of their, I guess what I would say, comfort zone. And a climate of, I won't say intolerance, a climate of less tolerance evolved. And I think that we found that, as kind of the dust settled, we found that climate very troubling.
You mentioned that the what would not have been in our front yard had we not been through that.
Oh, yeah, right. When you and I talked about this interview, I said there is now a sign in front of our house that would not have been there if it hadn't been a result of 9/11 that says, no matter where you are from, we're glad you're our neighbor. And it's in Arabic and in Spanish and in English. And those signs are all over this town, as are the signs, hate is not welcome here. And I love that this town feels this way. But I think it's too bad we have to put up the signs to prove it.
Well, and that sort of indirectly led us into a concern on both our parts about immigration. Do you want to mention the next sort of step after 9/11 that made us think more about the population and the immigrants amongst us
Well, we were, over the time that we've been here, the immigrant population, mainly Mexican and Central American, has really grown within the community, and those this population has a real home in this community, and the community is protective of that population for the in large part, and dependent on it, and it has a real feeling of compassion and support. And I think we probably weren't so aware of that until the incident that you and I talked about, but I know that Jacqueline's going to ask us the date on that. Do you remember
that? It was 2004. It was late 2004.
Okay. You tell.
Well, a number of us read in the paper that a man from Guatemala who had come here legally and who had a citizen wife and three citizen children had been deported. And at that point, none of us knew anything really about immigration and the law and all that. But a number of us in our church, Nassau Presbyterian Church, said, you know, there's something wrong with that. And this doesn't make sense that a person who is married to citizens and to a citizen and has citizen children can be deported. And that sort of started an immigration committee at the church and a lot of learning. And in the case of this man, Mr. Davila, we supported his family while he was deported and worked with his lawyer to get him back, ultimately successfully. But it really brought home to us that there was a lot of threat to our immigrant community, primarily the undocumented part of that community, and that sort of started a lot of effort on our part, the two of us and many others, largely through our church, to get involved in the immigrant community.
I think the other thing that incident is exactly what started us, but as I remember it, the ICE workers went into the Davila home and in the night and took Mr. Davila out in handcuffs.
In front of his kids, yeah. And our church has had a long history of supporting and welcoming refugees, and I think we've now supported and sponsored about a dozen refugee families over the years. But refugees come here legally, and we've always been involved with that. But now we start to worry more about those who didn't come here legally but came here to escape what's still going on in Central America and other problems. So that Davila Institute or incident really got us going in a serious way.
Right. The other related but not related, I think that I've been pretty liberal Democrat all my life. Bill, far more conservative, mostly financially. But I think it was just a growing experience for us both to kind of really empathize with this population. And Bill got even more active and was going through First Friends to visit people who were being held in the Elizabeth Detention Center, and he went with people partly connected to Nassau Press and people in the community who were equally concerned. And when he was one person with whom he visited in the Elizabeth Detention Center was a man from Kashmir, a Christian in Kashmir, which is a difficult position to be in, and he had been persecuted and hunted down and came to the U.S. seeking asylum and was put into the Elizabeth Detention Center, where he stayed for quite a while they tried to figure out what would be his future. And Bill got to know him and got to consider him a friend, be very fond of him, and committed to trying to help him on the get out of the Elizabeth Detention Center and have a more positive, productive life. And that happened. He was there for a while, and then one night we got a call from John, our friend in detention, saying they're going to let me out. Can you come pick me up? So Bill and another friend, Bob Duncan from Princeton, went up at 10 o'clock at night to the warehouse where they keep the detainees and brought John back to Princeton. And we didn't have much warning this was going to happen, and we weren't quite sure what to do about his future or what
we
to do with him.
We had about 2 hours of warning is what we amounted to.
So then came the short term what to do with him, but more the long term, because his legal status was still uncertain. And a friend of ours, David McAlpin, suggested that we reach out to the people in Robeson House, which is on Witherspoon Street, 110 Witherspoon Street, and is connected with the Witherspoon Street Presbyterian Church. And the Robeson House had in the past allowed people who were in transition to live there. And they, we asked Ben Colbert and the people at Witherspoon Press, and they said, sure, he can live in Robeson House. And they were, that congregation was incredibly supportive and welcoming, as was the Nassau Press congregation. So John lived in Robeson House for 2 years, which is kind of catty corner across from the library where we are right now. And he could live there with dignity. He used the library on a daily basis. He reached out into the community. He made friendships. If we had 4 weeks to do this interview, we could discuss the legal process. But eventually, John now lives happily, not in the U.S., but as a free man in Europe.
We spent two years trying to get him legal status here, based on the persecution that he had faced, the religious persecution he faced in Kashmir. And we took him all the way to the Circuit Court of Appeals, the third step that we took, and he ultimately was turned down. But he's now living free and happy in Finland. A loss to the U.S., but at least we have a man who's got freedom that he wouldn't have had before. So. Besides the immigration kind of, besides the immigration efforts, what else that we've gotten involved in around here through the church comes to mind for you?
Well, for both of us, the church has played a really big part in our life, certainly for the last 15, 20 years. And we didn't grow up as Presbyterians, and we did some church shopping because certainly after 9/11, though we'd been churchgoers before that, we felt a community of faith would really be really important to us. And Nassau has a very strong reputation for mission and social justice and outreach. And so we tried it, and that has been our church home and the focus of a lot of our community activity for the past 20 years. We've both done a lot through it.
Well, it's led us into through we have a partnership with a church in Trenton, a very diverse church there, a very poor church there, poor in financially, but rich in terms of what they do in the community. And so we've gotten involved in a lot of activities with them as an urban partner. And that urban partnership has led us to think about other things that we can do in Trenton, and you might want to mention some of the things that have gone on in Trenton that we've been involved in.
Right, we've both done ESL tutoring, though neither one of us speak more than about three sentences of Spanish. We've done English conversation classes in Trenton, and we've done Grand Pals in the Robbins School in Trenton. I've also done Grand Pals in Princeton. Princeton has...
What is Grand Pals?
Oh, Grand Pals is mature people going to read and interact with almost always second graders, could be first and second graders. And it's a joy to do it in Princeton. In Princeton, there are probably for every second grader who wants a grand pal, there are grand pals waiting to be a grand pal. In Trenton, not so much. So where we both did that for a few years in Trenton while we could, and there would be maybe five or six very active, anxious second graders waiting for us. So we felt kind of like rock stars when we go there. They say, the grand pals are coming, the grand pals are coming. So in Princeton, it's really nice because they say, hi, grand pal. But Trenton was pretty amazing experience. We talked about the church. I really like being part of this church. We talked about things we were doing next week. In the kitchen of Nassau Press, with the help of some other friends from that church, we will be preparing lunches for 90 Homefront campers.
And what's Homefront?
Lunches. Homefront
is a lot of people know about Homefront, but maybe some don't.
Okay. Homefront is a agency center located mostly in Ewing, but their aim is to stop homelessness in central New Jersey. And they're doing a really good job. And I might say our daughter works there, which might have something to do with the 90 lunches.
So outside of the church, what other things have you been involved in the community? I know that the love of the library goes back to before I knew you, when you were a small child, and that has never changed over the years. You want to say how that's grown to what you are doing with the library today?
Sure. Probably it was a good place not to start our interview, because once launched on the library, it's hard for me to change course. I've done other things like the adult school and the senior resource center. A few other things that I've really liked doing, but I am pretty passionate about the concept of a free public library, and have been, is it safe to say, a user since I was a teenager?
Yeah.
A library user. And loved this library when I first came here, but when I first came here, I could also use the university library. And when I first people who listen to this interview will not remember, or some will remember, the library before it was renovated. And round about maybe probably 12, 14, 15 years ago now, Barbara Johnson, who was head of the Friends of the Library, asked me to join the Friends Council, which I did and totally loved it. Friends being the kind of volunteer worker bee part of the volunteer part of the library. And when I was just starting with them, they were selling the concept, or they had sold the concept of the new library, and it was just starting to be being built. But there was a big cry around the town around town at that time whether to keep the library where it is currently, and we are right this minute, right in the heart of Princeton, the temporary home while the library was being renovated was in the Princeton Shopping Center. And many, many people in the community thought that's where the library should stay, or there should be a branch, or that's where it should be, because parking was easy and it was very accessible. And I'm very proud of the people.
Accessible if you had a car.
If you had a car, right. Exactly, that's the point. People in the true kind of believers in what a public library should be said, no, it needs to stay right downtown, so by foot it's available to as much of the town as it could possibly be, and that's where it should be, central in the town, and that's where it is. So... So I was on the Friends Council for a long time and worked on benefits and worked on all annual appeal. And the first benefit that we had, one of the first we had not real well-known speakers. We thought if we could just get 100 people to come, we would be so proud, and we couldn't. So we hit 80, and we were pretty pleased with ourselves. I might say now, last year and for the past years, the fall benefit cuts off at 400 people and has a wait list. And that is a measure of how this town feels about the library and the work that the Friends do. So I worked on the Friends for a while, eventually becoming president of the Friends, and really, really liking. I liked to work as a team. They were an incredible team. We had a couple of things that didn't work as well. We had a store. There was a little store downstairs for a while. And Leslie Berger, who was then director of the library, and I thought, this is so much fun. We'll have a store. We can shop for the store in the city. We'll choose things we love. Everyone will want to come and buy them. And it's just going to be our toy. However, so with the one part was fun. We did go to the gift show and buy things. That was pretty much the only fun time. People didn't buy things. People stole things occasionally. People didn't want to volunteer in the store. So it got to be awkward.
Not awkward. It was a failure.
Well, yes. Yeah.
I mean, yeah, you can't sugarcoat it.
No, you can't. It was a failure. Meanwhile, across the library, there are about three shelves dedicated to Friends Book Sale. It's where we sold used books. So finally, Leslie said, let's get real. It's not going to work. Got rid of the store. That was a little bit painful. And the Friends Book Sale took over that space. And just as a point of pride, I would say every month that book sale, used book sale, brings in about $10,000 to the library.
At $2 or $3 a pop.
At $2 or $3, yeah. Yeah, it's pretty amazing. And it's the best. It's so environmentally sound. We are recycling books over and over and over, and everyone benefits. And I'm incredibly impressed by what the Friends do with that book sale. So I am now no longer a friend. Now I am a trustee, which are trustees are appointed by the town to oversee the library. And this year I'm president of the trustees. I, as you probably gathered from the interview, I just believe in the concept of a really fine public library, opening its doors to everyone and serving to the extent that we possibly can every single person in this community. And when the library was, the new library took form and stood up, people called it the community living room. It has a fireplace, it has comfortable seating all over, it has a patio where you can eat, it has a cafe. Pretty amazing. But in the past few years, it's not simply community living room anymore. It's so much more. As we are in a troubled time nationally, there needs to be a place for civic discourse, a place that addresses the new immigrants, the undocumented population, the olders, the youngers, and I just think it's one of the coolest public libraries anytime, anywhere.
Don't forget
my favorite thing ever.
The favorite thing ever.
Yes.
From the library.
This is my total favorite thing ever. I might have been president of the Friends, or anyway, head of the benefit when the library hit its 100th anniversary. And I had this dream of this fundraising activity that we could do, and we did it. So we called it, in their own words, and we went out throughout the community, and we got every kind of Princeton-based mover and shaker who was kind of famous to write a passage from their own works in their own hand on paper that we had specially made, and then we framed them all and we auctioned them all. But the process of gathering in their own words was so exciting. It was like a great treasure hunt. We got Toni Morrison, we got John McPhee, we got John Lithgow, we got B.B. Newworth, we got Mary Chapin Carpenter, we got the big name local authors, we got Bill Bradley. We just had just so many.
And don't forget my favorite.
You should tell about your favorite, because that was definitely your favorite.
We got Pete Carril, who was the former basketball coach at Princeton and was famous for Princeton beating teams that they shouldn't beat, and they did it because they had this famous backdoor play that Pete Carril had sort of invented, if you will. And so the library got Pete Carril to diagram the backdoor play for this event, and it was one of the big sellers.
Yeah, it was really incredibly nice event, and it made money. That was my favorite library thing I've ever done.
Yeah. So that's sort of the library story.
I was going to say, I was looking, we both made notes of a few things that I wanted to include. One of the Princeton things that I would have found surprising was only a few years ago when we realized that not just Trenton, there was food insecure population. There was also a food insecure population in Princeton, next to the privileged kids of professors or successful, financially successful people were people who were really food insecure. So people in town, Russ Wishnick, I think, was maybe the mover and shaker, started SHUP, which was Send Hunger Packing Princeton. And the way it works is that every weekend, kids who are food insecure take a backpack of food that gets them through the weekend. And they've done it in a way that's incredibly sensitive, so the kids are not, they don't feel embarrassed about, I don't think they do, embarrassed about it. The population is pretty wild. They do an incredible amount of backpacks and food supplying. And now they've done it so they can work with the same population through the summer. So it, you know, Princeton from the outside and Princeton from the inside, it's so complicated because there's just part of everything in this community.
what they recognized was that the kids, these kids are, through government programs, are fed school lunches, and so they're fed during the school year, or school day, mm-hmm. but they weren't fed, then they'd go home on a weekend and they'd be hungry, so this was filling a major gap. As we sort of look forward, what are the most significant things that you expect to be involved in and doing in the next year, and what's the short-term future of Princeton look like?
I think I'll certainly be working with the library. The library is involved in putting together a strategic plan now and trying to know how to, and I'm working on that committee, how to meet the needs of a community where we are trying, as we have been trying, but hope we can meet the needs of every person in this community. And there are still mainly undocumented population who are very wary of being able to come out and take part in a public space. That reminds me of something you should talk about, are the community ID cards.
Oh, yeah, something we did at the library, but I've been involved in the Latin American Legal Defense and Education Fund, and one of the things that one of the activities that we started was community ID cards, which for people who are undocumented, they have nothing that identifies where they live, because they may have a passport from wherever they came from, but they don't have something that says, right, I live in this area in Princeton. It was then expanded to the whole county. So we started and are continuing to issue ID cards to people, and all they have to do is prove who they are, which they can do with a passport, and prove where they live, which they can do with a bill from public service or a phone bill or whatever. And then they're issued a community ID card, which enables them to, I'm sure hot top on Pam's list, is they can join the library.
Yes.
They can go free to the library. They can join the community pool. They can take advantage of community services. And maybe, and more importantly, from a safety standpoint, is if they're involved as a witness or a victim to a crime, the police do not check their immigration status, so they can feel free to go and go to the police and say, this has been a problem, or if they're picked up for something, they can say, okay, we're a legitimate resident of Princeton, and they're treated that way, treated with respect and without legal implications from the police. So and you know, this that Latin American Legal Defense and Education Fund does a great deal. That's we mentioned ESL. That's the group that sponsors the ESL program. But okay, get back to.
So
the coming year.
Well, I just think it's a time that we're all, you know, maybe this interview will, people will listen to it in 10 or 20 years and they'll say, yikes, that was a Trump presidency. Was it really that upsetting? And I would like to think in 20 years they'll say it wasn't, but we're in the middle of it right now, and I can see that it's making a climate of such civil discord, and I'm hoping the library, I know the library will do its best to help all voices be heard, and this town is so progressive and so caring and so committed that I would not ever follow people who go to live in Florida or retire to South Carolina. I love this community. It offers everything for, it's kind of like Harrods in Princeton, from the cradle to the grave. There is something really valuable and important for everybody in this town. I just think that's a perfect last note, isn't it?
Well, it is, but I think the other thing that we're actively involved in is the Robeson House.
Oh yeah.
And
good point.
That's something that's just sort of getting underway. Well, the house has been there for a while, but the renovation and all is just really getting started. And the whole idea is to take these social justice issues and civil rights issues and have a place that was this is Paul Robeson's birthplace that can be a memorial to him, but also to his ideals in civil justice, civil rights, that's. We're both on the board of that organization, and hope that that'll be will become another significant part of Central Princeton in terms of those kind of activities.
So we hope in 20 years people will look back and say, "Hey, so the Robeson House was started then."
Yeah. Right.
Okay. So we good?
Yeah, I think that's. I don't think of another.
I know, I'm going to sit up in bed tonight and go, oh, I wish I'd said that. So I think we're
yeah.
good, and thank you.
Thank you for your time. This is the end of the recording.